This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, the 18th of August, 2011. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood. Coming up on the newscast: pressure on the Syrian regime increases as US President Barack Obama calls on Bashar al-Assad to step down. In the Philippines, women's advocates push for a reproductive health bill. And we go to the German port of Bremen, where Greenpeace is building the next defender of the world's oceans, Rainbow Warrior 3. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Andrew Stelzer with these headlines for Free Speech Radio News. 7 Israelis were killed and at least 20 injured in a series of attacks in southern Israel. The Israeli military retaliated with airstrikes on Gaza, killing at least 5 Palestinians. The attackers reportedly crossed into Israel from Egypt's Sinai Peninsula. They fired on several buses and cars and planted an explosive device on the road. Israeli Defense Forces say they killed several of the gunmen. It's unknown how many escaped or were captured alive. The Israeli government immediately blamed the attacks on Hamas in the Gaza Strip, although Gaza is more than 130 miles away and a Hamas spokesperson denied any involvement. Weakened security in Sinai has been a growing concern since the Egyptian Revolution. Authorities in India have struck a deal with anti-corruption activist Anna Hazare, allowing him to continue his hunger strike for the next 15 days. Hazare's arrest earlier this week sparked massive protests across the country, forcing the government to order his release. But he refused to leave the prison unless permitted to go ahead with his fast. Bismillah Gilani reports.
The breakthrough came after 2 days of hard negotiations between Anna Hazare's associates and the government. The 74-year-old Hazare will begin his 15-day fast tomorrow. Tens of thousands of his supporters are expected to join him. Kiran Bedi is a member of Hazare's group, India Against Corruption.
It's finding a middle path, because after all, that's what it's all about. We heard them, they heard us, and finally we thought that was the way to begin.
Hazare is demanding strong legislation to deal with corruption. Although the government presented a draft anti-corruption law in the parliament last week, Hazare called the proposal toothless because it exempts the prime minister, the judiciary, and several other government officials from being investigated. Bismillah Gilani, Free Speech Radio News, New Delhi.
Hundreds of foreign students in the U.S. for the summer walked off their jobs and held a protest outside the Hershey chocolate packing plant in Palmyra, Pennsylvania, on Wednesday. The workers claim the J-1 visas they paid thousands of dollars for were for a cultural immersion experience, but instead they ended up as minimum wage laborers who could barely afford rent. The students from Asia and Europe also criticized Hershey for using them as low-paid workers instead of hiring local people at decent wages. Hershey said both the warehouse and the visas were handled by contractors. The students say they will remain on strike, which could put their visas at risk. Striking Verizon workers will be protesting outside the home of company CEO Lowell McAdam tonight as the nearly two-week-old work stoppage intensifies. About 45,000 workers in 9 states are on strike, upset about the phone company's proposed pension freeze and call for more employee contributions to their own health care. On Wednesday, Verizon said they would suspend many of the striking workers' health care benefits at the end of the month if they haven't returned to their jobs. Communications Workers of America District 1 Coordinator Patrick Welsh says the threat by Verizon is cruel.
They can certainly afford to continue these benefits, but they decided that because we're out on strike, they're going to put the squeeze on the active members, and they're pushing really hard in order to scare them. Well, that's not going to work. We need our medical benefits. There's no two ways about it, but it just shows you how uncaring they are, because we have thousands and thousands of workers with no medical care. Many of them have children and that have neurological diseases. Many of them have to have kidney dialysis. And many of our workers, many of our members need the constant medical care and prescription drugs.
A Verizon spokesperson says if the workers have their benefits cut off, they will still be eligible for coverage under COBRA. As the rainy season brings more sickness and death to Haiti, a new report says the international community isn't devoting the resources necessary to counter the spread of the cholera epidemic that began last year. Ansel Herz has more.
The report from the Center for Economic and Policy Research says the international community's response to Haiti's cholera epidemic dropped off dramatically after the initial outbreak last October. Studies say UN peacekeeping troops inadvertently introduced the disease to the island nation. Since then, over 6,000 people have died, including 385 in July alone. But funding for the UN's cholera response flatlined back in February, the report says. Dozens of treatment centers in some of Haiti's most affected regions have been closed down as multi-million dollar NGOs withdrew. Jake Johnston is one of the report's co-authors.
But with the rainy season and with the spike in the cholera cases that we were seeing and at different NGOs throughout the country were reporting, we realized that we really needed to do something and kind of shine some light on this and get it back into everyone's attention that this hasn't ended. The cholera epidemic is still going. It's still killing people. It's still sickening people at a pretty alarming rate.
The report says more treatment centers need to reopen in rural areas where mortality rates are the highest. Some studies estimate Haiti will experience as many as 700,000 cholera cases and 11,000 deaths by November if treatment efforts are not ramped up. Ansel Hers, FSRN.
The Satellite Sentinel Project has discovered what may be three mass graves in Sudan's southern state of Kordofan. The area saw clashes between government forces and rebels this past June. The satellite images released show what could be piles of corpses wrapped in body bags or tarps. Another image, supplemented by eyewitness accounts, indicates a possible third mass grave under a water tower. Earlier this week, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights called for an investigation into possible crimes against humanity and war crimes during fighting in Kordofan earlier this year. And those are today's headlines. For Free Speech Radio News from Oakland, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
I'm Danny Wood in San Francisco. After months of international condemnation of the Syrian regime's violent crackdown on civilians, U.S. President Barack Obama called on Syrian leader Bashar al-Assad to step down. In a statement, Obama said the U.S. will not impose this transition upon Syria, as officials have heard their strong desire that there not be foreign intervention in their movement. Speaking today in Washington, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said the regime has shown contempt for its people.
The people of Syria deserve a government that respects their dignity, protects their rights, and lives up to their aspirations. Assad is standing in their way. For the sake of the Syrian people, the time has come for him to step aside and leave this transition to the Syrians themselves. And that is what we will continue to work to achieve.
Obama announced new U.S. sanctions, including a freeze on all Syrian government assets under U.S. jurisdiction and a ban on U.S. imports of Syrian petroleum. The sanctions also prohibit U.S. citizens from engaging in any transaction with the Syrian government. The European Union, Britain, Germany, and France also issued statements calling on al-Assad to leave power. The announcements come as the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights published the results of a fact-finding mission on Syria that says members of the regime may have committed crimes against humanity and should be referred to the International Criminal Court. Rupert Colville is a spokesperson for the UN Human Rights Office.
They managed to talk to witnesses in four countries, including Syria, although they weren't able physically to get into Syria. They interviewed 180 witnesses in all. These included defectors from the military, from the police, and from other security forces, many of whom had refused to fire on civilians. And they also report that many soldiers and other security officials who tried to defect or who refused to shoot civilians were themselves shot and summarily executed on the spot.
The report also says the security forces have fired indiscriminately at demonstrators, killed and injured protesters inside hospitals, and targeted and tortured children. The investigators say they have the names of more than 1,900 people killed since mid-March. And today, the regime continued its assault on the port city of Latakia, where hundreds of people are being held in a sports stadium. A doctor in the local hospital, who spoke to the online news site Babylon and Beyond via Skype today, said gunmen are continuing to terrorize the city and 50 people have been killed in the last 4 days. He said lots of wounded people are on the floor of the hospital, where they lack beds and medical supplies. The fate of thousands of Palestinians who fled a refugee camp earlier this week to escape shelling by the Syrian Navy remains unknown. President Barack Obama has now wrapped up his 3-day tour of rural communities in the Midwest. Matt Laszlo explores the policy prescriptions he floated and asked some experts if they're enough.
For the past few days, President Obama has been addressing crowds of business owners, farmers, and students in the Midwest. Even with the lingering bad economy, he painted an optimistic picture of America's future.
There are two things that I know for sure. America is going to come back from this recession stronger than before. That I'm convinced of. I believe that. And I'm also convinced that comeback isn't going to be driven by Washington.
So if not politicians, then who will bring the U.S. out of this economic mire? In his address at the Northeast Iowa Community College, the president hailed the heartland as a key force to getting the economy back on track.
It's going to begin in the classrooms of community colleges like this one. It's going to start on the ranch lands and farms of the Midwest, in the workshops of basement inventors, in the storefronts of small business owners.
Republican presidential candidates who are storming the Midwest as well accuse the president of playing politics instead of leading. Professor Robert Shapiro of the progressive think tank NDN says yes, there was some politics involved, but that isn't a bad thing.
I think that in a period in which the opposition is getting their message out through the political calendar around the Republican nomination, it's perfectly natural that the White House would want to get their message out as well.
Besides Iowa, the president spent time in Illinois and Minnesota, three states he won in the last election, and three states his campaign sees as battlegrounds in 2012. Those three states have a combined average unemployment rate of 7.3%, nearly 2 points below the national average. Unemployment rates are much higher in other regions, such as the South. Bo Bolu is the director of the Southern Rural Development Center at Mississippi State University. He says the South could use a White House visit, even if the president won't get much support there in his next election.
It's true he is Republican country, but I don't think we're thinking about this in terms of political parties. We are about talking about helping get communities and people back on their feet. You know, and there's a whole lot of them in the South that could use that kind of attention.
Throughout this summer, the White House has been sending administration officials to rural areas. Bolu says tours like that can pay off, but he wants to see some concrete proposals too.
We've had a lot of these kinds of listening sessions over the years, and sometimes, and what it is, it's a nice way to rub shoulders and interact with the common folk, the people in communities across America, and that's very, very valuable. The question is, what happens when you get back home?
As for the policy side of the Midwest trip, the president unveiled some small measures that he says can make an impact in rural communities, including increasing investments for rural small businesses and expanding job assistance programs at the Department of Agriculture. Professor Shapiro of NDN says those won't be too hard to get accomplished.
The measures he's proposing he can do by executive order. He doesn't need Congress. And so, yes, I think it will succeed.
Poverty experts say more is needed, though. Joy Moses is an analyst at the Center for American Progress.
We would like to see more investments in things like national service that directly employ low-income youth. Other things that are very helpful is if we address the amounts of foreclosed property we have and use that as a means of employing workers.
After a 10-day vacation in Martha's Vineyard, the president plans to lay out an eagerly anticipated new jobs blueprint. Matt Laszlo, FSRN, Washington.
U.S. Education Secretary Arnie Duncan recently caused a stir in the education community when he announced, after months of congressional inaction, the administration was offering relief from a key provision of the country's education law, No Child Left Behind. States can now apply for waivers to bypass a central provision of the law, but as Community News Production Institute reporter Jessel Knorr reports, Duncan's new program does little to address the law's most criticized component.
Passed in 2002, No Child Left Behind aimed to usher in a new era of accountability in public education by measuring student achievement through increased testing. A key provision mandates schools show improvement or face tough sanctions. And every school is required to reach 100% proficiency in math and reading by 2014 or risk losing federal aid. But high numbers of schools are failing to meet the standards, which prompted the education secretary to create the new waiver program, in which states can now apply for exemption. Despite the reprieve from the tough testing standards, many education advocates are concerned waivers will only be granted to states that adopt the administration's favored reforms. Karen Royale is the co-founder of the grassroots education advocacy group, Parents Across America.
We're jumping out of the skillet and into the frying pan.
In its signature Race to the Top program, the Obama administration awarded millions of dollars to states that, in part, aggressively expanded charter schools and linked teacher pay to test scores. As a public school parent in New Orleans, where 70% of students attend charter schools, Royale said she rejects Duncan's waiver program.
A lot of the requirements of the Race to the Top program are even worse than No Child Left Behind, and doesn't actually provide enough accountability or parental involvement or community involvement. What it really does more of is just makes more testing for children and privatizing of public schools.
Other grassroots education advocates, as well as teachers, have also condemned Duncan's move. They are concerned that Duncan's waiver plan may be substituted for an overhaul of federal education law. They say it does not change their fundamental criticism of No Child Left Behind, that it has resulted in overtesting of public school students. Monty Neal is with the education nonprofit, the National Center for Fair and Open Testing.
For schools serving poor kids in general, immigrants, programs and schools serving lots of kids with disabilities, English language learners, racial minorities, all you kinds of groups that typically don't do as well under our current school system, and who are therefore facing the most pressure, and whose teachers are facing the most pressure, that pressure is going to stay there, and it may even increase.
Lyons Community School in Brooklyn serves students of color from low-income communities. Although the school is mostly empty right now, 18-year-old high school junior Shanice McKee is here, busy preparing for a world history exam she needs to graduate.
I would say, like, it's too much. I would say, like, it put a lot of, like, a lot of pressure on the kids. And, like, they're looking at it and they be like, you know what, it's too much. Like, I can't do it. And, like, I can't. I would say, like, classwork is good and a little bit of exam in classes is good. It's really good for the children and they really prefer that. But not the exams. It's a lot. It's too much.
McKee, a recent immigrant from Grenada, says the overtesting drives students away from school.
That's why they're on the street right now. They don't really, because they're pressuring them and they can't take it no more. That's why they drop out.
It's just 2 days before the state test, but only a handful of the 30 students assigned to the class showed up. That does not surprise Matt Bateski, Shanice McKee's global history teacher.
Tests don't make kids stay in school. You know, no kids saying, I gotta go to school today because this is, you know, I love tests.
Bateski says No Child Left Behind prioritizes test scores over learning.
One of the things that we do constantly now is just test prep all the time. Our curriculum is basically, here's our test, how can we get our students to pass it? Because it's so high stakes that if the students don't pass it, they don't graduate. And if they don't graduate, you know, that hurts the student and also hurts their school.
Secretary Duncan's plan to further link teacher performance and pay to student test scores concerns Bateski.
I've worked my whole career in inner city schools, and for 8 years, by every metric the state, the city, and the federal government have, I've been a failure. My kids don't tell me I'm a failure. My parents don't tell me I'm a failure. My administrators have never told me I'm a failure. But the governments have been saying I'm a failure because my students haven't made their yearly progress.
Bateski and other education advocates worry such policies will discourage teachers from working in high-need communities.
And I think every teacher in the world knows this. It's much easier to teach in a place where socioeconomic status isn't as big of an issue. So who's going to work in the urban schools? Who's going to work in the poor schools? If you're constantly being told, okay, you're going to be fired if you don't do this, or you're going to not be paid your annual salary if you don't do this.
For the past 2 decades, Lois Weiner has taught education at Teachers College in New Jersey. And before that, she spent 15 years as a public school teacher. She argues that Duncan's reforms are an attack on public education. She says rank-and-file teachers must break from union leadership and mobilized to strongly oppose the Obama administration's harmful education policies.
Teachers have to take ownership of their unions. Unlike school boards, unions are membership organizations. And we can't just blame union leaders. We have to understand that the issue here is that teachers don't see the unions as vehicles for struggle. And I think that if that doesn't happen, we really are going to see the destruction of public education in this country.
Grassroots education advocates like Weiner have vowed to increase the pressure on the Obama administration to address excessive high-stakes testing in public schools. Less than 2 weeks after Duncan's announcement, Kentucky, Michigan, Minnesota, and Tennessee have already applied for waivers. Jessel Noor, FSRN, New York.
At a ceremony in Singapore this week, the Greenpeace ship Rainbow Warrior 2 was officially retired from service. After more than 20 years campaigning for the environment, it's being transferred to the NGO Friendship, based in Bangladesh, for use as a hospital ship. Its successor, Rainbow Warrior 3, is due to be launched in October and is currently being built in the German port of Bremen. Pete Wilcox has served as a captain of the Rainbow Warrior ships since the early 1980s. Including for the Rainbow Warrior 1 that was bombed and sunk by the French Secret Service in 1985. He's been looking over his new ship in Bremen and he joins us now. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Thank you.
When the Dalai Lama visited Rainbow Warrior 2 back in the early 90s, he described it, a little tongue-in-cheek perhaps, it's a small boat, a little untidy. How do you remember Rainbow Warrior 2 and could you describe it for us?
To most of us, she looked kind of modern because we had put in a completely new interior. Untidy, I suppose, by some standards, but she was a three-masted schooner. The hull was built in 1955. We bought her after the first boat was blown up and spent about 2 years converting her into a Greenpeace boat. She went thousands and thousands of miles for us many times around the world, and was a good boat.
Can you tell us a little bit about the name of the boats? The Rainbow Warrior comes from a Native American legend. Can you tell us a bit more about that and how you came up with that name?
That's what my colleagues in Europe named the first boat. It comes from a Cree legend. A woman named Eyes of Fire is talking to her son and explains how when the earth gets sick, a group of people of all different races will come together and help heal it. And that was the legend of the Rainbow Warriors. That legend resonated with many of us, and that's why we've picked the name.
You have a very long history with the Rainbow Warrior, and some of the first campaigns you were involved with were against Soviet mechanized whaling. What were the main obstacles back then you faced when you were mounting a campaign like that 3 decades ago?
Well, most of the time it was coming up with enough money to buy fuel to get the boat underway. Those were the back in the days where we did everything ourselves. The inflatables were generally secondhand, patched together with any kind of outboard engine we could get. But yet the campaigns were as successful as anything we've done because it really struck a chord or struck the imagination of the general public. Most people had no idea that the Soviet whaling boats were operating off the coast of California. And by just illustrating the fact and bringing it to everybody's attention, it created a huge uproar.
In 1985, the Rainbow Warrior was bombed and sunk in New Zealand by French secret agents. That was because of your campaign against French nuclear testing in the Pacific, and one of your crew was killed in that attack. How do you regard that attack now, and how did that change the way Greenpeace went about its work?
Well, it didn't really change the way we went about our work. I mean, infiltrating Greenpeace, which is what the French agents did in those days, was about as difficult as infiltrating the YMCA, and I think that was one of our strengths, not one of our problems. We had just come from the Marshall Islands, where we had moved an atoll of about 350 people that had been badly contaminated during the 1950s to a place that was a little bit safer, and went from there down to New Zealand, where we were getting ready to go after French Polynesia. And the French were so scared about Greenpeace bringing a large ship to Tahiti and to Polynesia that they decided that we should never leave New Zealand, and so they bombed the boat there.
And on the 20th anniversary of marking that attack, you went back to New Zealand, and some fishermen there staged a protest against you because of Greenpeace campaigning against bottom trawling. But you said at the time, bared buttocks and paint bombs we can live with, referring to how they were protesting. In those early days, you tended to campaign against seal and whale hunting, and more recently and following that, you've transitioned into other issues like the overfishing and offshore oil exploration. What do you think about that change of focus, and how has that change of focus affected how you campaign?
Well, I don't really see it so much as a change of focus. We have always been concerned with issues that affect the oceans, and overfishing is something that's gone on for years and years and years, and it was a focus of our campaigns 20 years ago, and it's a focus of our campaigns today. We just did some very tough actions in the Mediterranean over bluefin tuna fishing, where the stocks have been reduced to 10% of what they should be. And in fact, we're anticipating doing more fisheries work this year, because we can't keep treating the oceans as if they're an unlimited resource. They're not. They're a very finite resource.
How do you see yourselves these days? Do you regard Greenpeace as a radical environmental movement, or do you see it as something that's evolved from being that and is now slightly different?
I suppose it's become much more mainstream. I think, but that's as much of a factor as general society changing as Greenpeace changing. I mean, I think most third and fourth grade children realize that many of the ways we live on the planet don't make sense, and that we have to change that. Certainly, Greenpeace has grown in the 40 years it's been in existence. We're not simply a protest organization anymore on the ships. We're doing much more research. Three out of my four last trips have been research ones with scientists on board. And that doesn't always create the most dramatic image, but it's a very effective tool for trying to promote change, for trying to get laws changed, for trying to get treaties changed. And it's a way that we have grown and changed over the years.
You've been overlooking the construction of Rainbow Warrior 3 in Bremen. What do you think of the new boat? I understand it has quite a few new environmental features.
Well, I'm quite excited by it. I mean, the biggest difference is that it's really going to sail well. Both the previous Rainbow Warriors had sailing rigs, but they were cargo or industrial-type boats. This is a real sailboat with a keel and a fine underbody, a much bigger rig. It must be twice as high as the last Rainbow Warriors. It's just a whole level of sophistication and greenness better. It's the first time we've been able to build our own boat rather than buy a secondhand one and try to fix it up. And it reflects the best technology we could afford to put on it.
Captain Pete Wilcox, thanks very much for talking with Free Speech Radio News.
You're very welcome.
That's the program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Thanks for listening. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood.